Once in a while, you have the great fortune to meet someone who has taken life's experiences and woven them into the beautiful garment of wisdom. Couple the wisdom of years with charity and a willingness to share, and you have a valuable teacher.
I remember I'd been wallowing in, all the creeds and religious ideas for years. And I began to realize that I think in the world now there are about 80,000 religions. And I thought, well, my goodness me, I can't study 80,000 religions. Anyhow, at the end of it, if everybody's teaching me something different, I'm going to be more confused than when I start. But I had the good fortune of meeting a mystic from the Eastern country. And I went to see him to ask him if he'd try to put me on the right path. I wanted to know what truth was. And I remember this old man, he was a very old man with a beard, and when I went along to see him, I had to wait for a while because he was spending some time in meditation. And then he looked up and he said, "Well, my boy, what do you want?" And I thought, now, heavens, what do I want? What am I going to tell this man? I didn't want to be sitting there dumb, so I said to him, I just don't want to be like a vegetable. I want to know what life is about. I think the world's on the way to hell, and somebody ought to do something about it, and why, I went on. And he just looked at me, and then he smiled very kindly, and he said, "So, my boy, you want to save the world?"
Peter Pickover was born into a world that was rapidly changing. In 1909, a power struggle had begun and political agreements were being made that would, when Peter was just 5 years old, bring the world to war. At the age of 20, he presented the first of a series of broadcasts which became Australia's longest-running radio series. The hallmarks of the program were qualities of life that Peter treasured most: beauty, serenity, and sanctified common sense.
This is Uncle Peter bringing you another Quiet Hour, a non-sectarian program of music and the spoken word, presented especially for you, independent of your race, color, or creed, and dedicated to truth and to happier living.
People wanted something that had a little meaning to it. They, in those days, they liked nicer music. I don't mean the heavier classics, but the middle of the road, quiet ballads, melodic type of music. And so I came across the idea of establishing a sort of English countryside program, which started off with the bells of the old village church pealing away on the Sunday morning, with in the background a nightingale singing, then the organ of the old church playing, and then the morning hymn. And I thought we could convert this into quite a lovely little program. So I extended the whole thing. I put in a few hymns, a few good songs, and then I used to do a quiet hour talk, which was based on how to get the most out of life. You get out of life what you put into it, you know? And I had to be so careful because it was bordering on religion, and I had no intention of upsetting any orthodox religions at all, because everybody has a perfect right to their own beliefs, and where they are at this moment is where they should be. The only thing is, I discovered that I had to know more. I began to think, well, what about life? What's life all about? It surely is not what I can see. I probably felt a bit like the prodigal son, you know, who bailed out of his home early in the place, took all his inheritance, got out into the world and had a real good look at the world, and then say, my goodness me, is this all there is? Is this life what I see around me? And of course he eventually packed up and returned to his father. And that means a return to to sanity and the spiritual things. Because you've got to remember, you know, that everything that the mind conceives of, that is, everything you can see, hear, touch, taste, or smell, is passing. You see? The spiritual things, in spiritual things, there is no beginning and no ending. So that the actual spirit is living in eternity now as much as ever it will. And has it ever occurred to you, Graham, that when you look around the world, everything needful is here, supplied to us. The philosophers of thousands of years, accumulation of wisdom, and yet we still kill one another, we still murder. People are starving for want of food in other parts of the world, and you look in vain for love, for human kindness. You find it individually, but en masse, we're like a lot of mad animals at times, the way we behave, simply because we may have learned to control all other things, but the first thing we must learn to control, if we're going to find happiness and peace, is to control ourselves. And that means we have to put into life the things we want out of life. There's no other way.
The quiet hour on a Sunday morning, I think, was somewhat required listening for a lot of people in the Newcastle district. And that has been one of the special pleasures to hear again his voice in the Beauty That Endures tapes. And it was a thrill to know that he continued that work over the air, right up, pretty well up until his death. But thinking over the quiet hour, the thing that particularly appeals to me and the particular memory is that he provided something of a meeting place for people of like minds who recognized that life wasn't all just existing, but there was something, someone out there beyond us that cared, that even loved us, and that we could tap into for our everyday living. He didn't push any particular sectarian or doctrinal barrow, but I think that he allowed that every person could find their own measure of truth and reality. And here was a place where we could all join hands and say, yes, we agree at least on this, that there is someone, something that we can all relate to, regardless of our particular sectarian affiliations. And he interspersed it with music that set a very fine atmosphere. And it's interesting in these days to hear music that I just instantly associate with the quiet hour. All those, I'm going back 45 years, my own experience, on 2KO. I think of things like the Manchester Children's Choir singing the dance duet from Hansel and Gretel by Humperdinck. And on the other side of the record was Nymphs and Shepherds. And another one that I associate particularly with the quiet hour was a piece that I only found out quite recently, as a matter of fact, its title. And it's The Shepherd's Farewell from The Childhood of Christ by Berlioz. A haunting piece that begins with, I think it's an oboe theme, and then in comes the choir. But that, to me, is The Quiet Hour with Peter Pickover.
Ken Short has retired in Tasmania from a broadcasting career with the ABC. As a boy in Newcastle, Ken went along to one of 2KO's children's shows, and he recalls the impact of watching Peter on air.
These are the days of, I can drop a few names here, say from 2KO, Elmer Gibb. People will remember, I think it was the Cheerio Club, and people used to write in. They were the regular correspondents. There were people like Rickety Kate, and I can't remember some of the other names, but that one comes to mind. Jimmy Max at the piano, his program, A Fool, A Stool and a Piano. John O'Brien, Colin Welsh. I remember Colin Welsh doing the VP Day, the Victory in the Pacific broadcast from the awning of the CML building, which housed 2KO, and a long line that the engineer Max Pitskowski had cooked up for the occasion. These were fascinating days to me, and looking back in later years, in my teens, when I worked in an office, 2KO had lunchtime programs, and that was the time that I remember seeing first Matt Tapp, for instance. He used to MC the lunchtime shows. But I also remember seeing Peter Pickover through the glass, through the control booth. In the control room, they used to play the commercials on great big 16-inch disc transcriptions and also the serials. But Peter Pickover was at the microphone, and I remember looking through, oh, that looks fascinating. I'd love to do that sort of work. And then, after 40 years, nearly, as a broadcaster in front of the microphone, looking into a studio still has that fascination that I trace back to those days.
One day, Peter walked into a grocery store to buy some potatoes and recognised the grocer as the ventriloquist whose doll, Horace, was so popular with children.
I can't work out why a ventriloquist doll was popular on radio. On television, you can understand it's visual. But on radio, you only had two voices and that was it. But it was the comedy answers to the kids. Sometimes they'd think of an answer which had nothing to do with the riddle whatsoever. But it was a competition too. And the listeners like something in which they can take part. Various sessions, quiz programs and that. Well, the Victor Ice Cream Riddle Show was something like that. You didn't know whether he was going to get the right answer, whether they was going to win their ice cream or not.
Rick Sinclair worked for many years with Peter on the Victor Ice Cream Show. He says Peter knew exactly what he wanted from his performers, and in getting it, sometimes he could seem a little abrupt.
I suppose he had a position to fill, and he had to be that way. But when you got him off the air, if you go away in the car to do a show someplace, you got very close to a person. You talk about all sorts of things. I always remember the time when, I think it was My Fair Lady, was forbidden to be broadcast in Australia. He got a copy out from England and we all went out to his home at Wall's End and we all listened to this broadcast, you know. When you was listening to that, you mustn't speak, you mustn't do anything, the lights are subdued, and you just sat there. When it was over, you could discuss it, talk about anything, but while anything was on, no interruptions. That was Peter.
Peter's single-minded way of approaching opportunities was evident from the time that he started Radio 2KO with his friend Alan Fairhall. It was 1930, and Alan told Peter that someone was prepared to lend them £100.
I said, don't lose sight of it, get it. And he said, what are we going to do? I said, you get it, get the £100, say yes, we'll take it, we'll run the risk. So I raced round town and I bought old green baize they used to put on billiard tables. And his mother said, well, you can have the lounge room, we don't use it. And I got a bloke, Freddie Shaler, and I said, can you make a desk that we can put a mic on? Alan had a piece of marble, I think he got it from the local cemetery, and he made a microphone. I know where it is. I found it the other day. It's at Alan Bourne's in Beaumont Street, in Dawson Street. And I bottled some second-hand carpets, some second-hand shops. We got green baize, a job lot from Scott's Limited. Alan's brother used to work behind the Manchester counter, and we got it for a big discount. So we hung it all around the picture railing, blocked up the windows, put this. We had Feltex on the floor. That's it. Oh, second-hand Feltex. And a little stand, a little desk, and out the back we had a mother's washhouse, and he built up on shelves a transmitter. Then, of course, we had to get a decent stick, and we bought some big pieces of Oregon. And I used those Oregon years later. They're in my place at Barrington. I made beds out of them. They were lovely. They're still there. Nobody knows the 2KO's first master there. So anyhow, We got the stick up in the backyard, 50-foot stick, and came the great day when we went on the air as 2KO. It was previously 2KB. It went on the air as 2KO, and I'll never forget. I've got the only picture in captivity. It was the greatest day in our lives. I mean, we'd worked and worked and worked. We'd been kicked around and laughed at and ridiculed. We'd been, had the works, and I'll never forget that first night. The big night came, 8 o'clock, and the mayor of Newcastle, Charlie Parker, was the mayor in those days, and Charlie Parker came to open it. And there was a manager of Phillips Lamps and another bloke, Norm Whale, who was an accountant who was looking after the books, and myself. And we had the official opening by the Lord Mayor of Newcastle. And we went through till 11 o'clock that night, and at the end of it, I was absolutely stonkered. And so was Alan. We were so tired. And we just shook hands with each other, and we said, well, this is the beginning. I wonder where the end will be, you know. And his mother stuck her head in. She said, I've got your supper ready. And it was cheese sandwiches. This is a great big opening, the official opening. So we went out there, and I was so tired. And Alan had a great big bed in the front room, a big double bed. And I was too tired to go. And the pair of us just climbed. We had our cheese sandwiches and a cup of tea. And both of us climbed into this double bed. And that was the beginning of KO. We fell asleep, and I woke up in the morning and started the first broadcast of the morning. It was quiet out, 9 o'clock.
2KO wasn't Newcastle's first station, but from those humble beginnings, it went on to rate number one. The secret? A very talented crew, with Peter always at the helm.
There was Beryl Boardman, Elmer Gibbs, Matt Tapp, myself, and a few of the other staff on KO, and we used to have an awful lot of fun doing that, because I'd have to get the jokes would be sent in by the listener. Then I would have to rewrite the whole thing in a little drama form, you know, a small vignette. And then we would produce it as a little play. And, of course, we had a laughometer, we used to call it. It used to register the greatest laughter for the joke, and then the winner got the prize, whatever it may be.
The story that Peter will never forget, Peter Pickover, because, after all, we are talking about Peter, aren't we? Will never forget, forgive us for, he may be looking down upon us from far fields now, was when I was straight man to Colin Welch's quiz. It was lunchtime show, and we came big money in those days, like, you know, 5 shillings, you know, 6 shillings, 10 shillings was a big prize. And we came to the final question, and Colin had to say, righto, you have 10 seconds, and 10 seconds only, going for the big prize. What are the arms or legs of an octopus called? And the woman went, testicles! And Colin went, that's right, pay her the money. Now, that was brilliant, but Peter wanted to cut that. Yes, he wanted to cut that, but he couldn't cut it because it was on air, it was live. And I always thought after, that's the difference. If it had been me doing the quiz, I would have said, I beg your pardon, or Peter would have, but Colin was quick enough to say, that's right, pay her the money. But Peter afterwards, there was some post-mortem on that question even being allowed, you know.
Matt Tapp regarded Peter as his mentor, though he didn't always see eye to eye with his philosophies.
He was a pacifist. He did not want to go to war, and I don't mean dodge war, but in hindsight, he was quite correct. He had the thinking then that most people have today about war. But he and I differed on many things. Basically came back to, I was in hospital in England. I had my left leg blown off. My right foot was shot to blazes. I had other injuries. And I was surrounded by fellows who were amputees, burn cases. And I received a letter from Peter on pacifism and why I shouldn't be there at war. Now, it wasn't the right time to receive that letter. He had his beliefs. I was looking at these fellows either side of me in a very bad way, and it didn't sit well upon the shoulders. I would say that it took, post-war era, it took 5 years for me to realise that his philosophy was right, and for maybe to him to think maybe that was bad timing when I wrote that letter, because he wasn't to know when he wrote it that I was in hospital. As far as he was concerned, I was on a squadron and in aircraft. But that took a lot of getting used to, and especially coming back and finding that the fellow who should have been one above me had been killed in New Guinea, and the other bloke who went on to become the general manager, tremendous bloke, Clem Derwin, who was very, very badly, I think he's a TPI now, he was very badly affected. So therefore there was this effect, and a fellow named Ron Roberts, I don't know if you remember Ron Roberts, yeah, went on to become a very top broadcaster in
plays. He finished up with Grace Gibson Radio
Grace Productions. Gibson Productions, that's mm-hmm. right. Well, Ron was there when he went to war, John O'Brien went to war, Pat Barton went to war, and we all came back, and there was that feeling was there. We understood his philosophy, but at the same time we thought, look, we've been there and done it. You know, we have something that you haven't got. And that philosophy took a long while for us to mutually agree that everybody had their own point of view. But it didn't detract from the fact that he was a tremendously talented Christian man with an overall philosophy that was that could be accepted in a community for the better. That's my summing up.
Let me read to you something I read on the air just after World War II. Obviously, things cost less then than they do now. But this may help you to understand how society suffers when money has to be spent on destruction. At a luncheon hosted by the Newcastle Businessmen's Club, Mr. J.S. Strawn, the General Secretary of the YMCA, said that the total cost of the World War, apart from the loss of 30 million lives, was £80 billion. Now, this amount could be used to build a £500 home with £200 worth of furniture, placed in 5 acres of land worth £20 an acre for every family in England, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, Canada, the United States, Australia, France, Belgium, Germany, and Russia. And with part of what was left over, every city of 20,000 inhabitants and over in each country named could have £1 million library and £2 million university. The remainder could be set aside, and at 5% interest, it would yield £200 a year salary for 125,000 nurses. Surely that's food for thought, isn't it?
While some thought him an idealist, Peter lived his ideals and knew well the influence of his book readings after the war. Pat Henwood says that hearing Peter read one book, The Keeper of the Bees by Jean Stratton Porter, changed her whole life.
I was a young person with absolutely no direction. And there were a lot of us like that. We had no finance. We found our pleasures together. And on the serious side, you looked for things like Peter was offering. A high percentage of us, people my age, are well aware of him as a reader, well aware that we learned from his readings. Now, I learned from Keeper of the Bees so much, which really gave me food for thought, and it lay fallow till I could cope with it, which wasn't overnight. Keeper of the Bees covers avenues for people who are damaged physically, people who are slow learners, people who are of varying ages and from lots of different places. Young people, a soldier just back from the war, mortally wounded, he thought, but he found himself among the people who were featured in Keeper of the Bees, and there he learned that the beauty of nature is a healing thing. He was slow to learn because he had to learn to trust, and so it was that I followed this and realised that these people, often quiet people, are everywhere, and they don't make a lot of noise until they're sure of you, and they become very supportive. You in turn grow in grace and maybe become supportive to somebody out there.
Which, of course, you did go on to do in your work with
Indeed.
Lifeline.
Indeed. And long before that. And I needed it all because I too would know a rough road in my health.
I used to pick special books, really good books. I had a lot of stuff by Geoffrey Farnall, and then I loved all those books that Lloyd Douglas wrote, like Forgive Us Our Trespasses, Magnificent Obsession, Green Light. They were all made into films. And I was doing a lot of religious studies, and I got in touch with Lloyd Douglas in America and said, look, I'd love to be able to read your books, and it's the same philosophy as I'm teaching in my quiet hour and you believe in. And it's after getting a message across. It's not only just a story. It's got a lot of meaning in it. May I have permission to do your books? And he said, yes. So I did most of Lloyd Douglas's books, which was quite a good thing, and I loved doing them, and they were wonderful stories. Yes, there were a whole lot of stories I used to do, and they used to have a terrific following. I remember in various places of the Hunter Valley, on farms, they used to ring a big gong every day about 2 o'clock, and all the fellas off the farm would come running in and sit down and hear the story. And sometimes I'd read as much as an hour. I'd get so caught up in the story myself, you know. And some of the sad stories during the war, I'd look up and find the girl in the control operator sitting having a cry. She's carried away with them. But it was a wonderful thing, and there were people that were blind and couldn't read, and they used to listen. That was the only story they could get, you know, and they were wonderful.
I believe in the wonder of the out of doors, in the inspiration of the stars, and in the allurement of life in the open. I believe in the strength of the hills, in the silence of the night, in the music of the brook, and the music of the birds and the trees. I believe also that my body was made for action, that my mind was made for thinking, that my heart was made for loving in unison with the life in nature. And I believe that to laugh and sing, to swim and walk, to study and play, to eat and be happy, to be kind and free, and to grow strong and good is my God-given right. And I believe too that to be happy, I must be good. But to be loved, I must think love. And to be worthy, I must be kind. I believe that God is nearer than man, that I can hear him in the brooks and in the pine trees, and that I and the Father are one, and that happiness and lasting peace are mine as I live in this atmosphere of kindness so near to me, in this life and in the open world.
It was a a remarkable little home I lived in. It was 16 feet wide and 4 floors high. It was a segment of the old Waratah Terrace, and I had a bookshop, amongst many other things, in the basement. And Peter would come along there, and he would look for stories to read. This was in the early part of his reading the stories, and he'd look for whether the story was copyright, a recent print, or the real old ones he wanted. They were very serious. They weren't humorous types of stories at all. They were dramatic, semi-romantic, and he would look to see who published it and whether it was a recent edition. He got the real old books. He got quite a lot from me. And then later on, or about that time, he got in touch with one of the big book suppliers. I don't know which one, but one of the book suppliers. And he got the new issues that came out, and they'd send him up a complimentary copy. And eventually, I believe, one of the firms wrote and told him that when he read the story over the air, they got many more sales of that particular book. So he had a lot of followers for his stories.
That's what I mean. You've been keeping secrets from me, Mr. Hale. You didn't tell me you'd invented a soap saver as well as a mouse trap.
Oh, didn't I? I must have forgotten.
You're a very naughty man to forget, Mr. Hale. You know how interested I am in your work.
Shall we make a start now?
Not till you've told me everything there is to know about this latest invention of yours. I won't move an inch till you do.
Well, there's nothing to tell, really. I just strung it together and sent it along to the manufacturers.
Now you're just being modest. Come now, you don't have to fool with me like that, do you?
You're making a big mistake when you call me modest.
Oh, of course you wouldn't admit to it. I didn't expect you to. But if you don't tell me, I'll go out first thing on Monday morning and buy one. Then I'll write for all particulars to the manufacturing firm that made it.
Oh, but it's not on the market yet.
I can still write for particulars. And will. Now stop being so bashful and give me the whole story.
The whole story?
Yes. How you came to think of it in the first place. How it grew and when you sold it.
Well, you see, Emily's always complaining about wasting bits of soap.
Oh, that was wonderful of you. But I still can't understand why you didn't tell me about it.
Well, I didn't think it would turn out to be much.
Oh, and just wait till your bloodless mousetrap comes out. That should make you as an inventor.
Yes, it certainly should. Well, don't you think we'd better be leaving, Miss Lane?
Of course, Mr. Hale. I'll just get my wrap. And you can tell me more about your invention in the cab, can't you?
Peter playing a role with Beryl Boardman, one of the regulars on the lunchtime shows at 2KO, where she usually played characters while Matt Tapp fed her the lines. Her best-known character, Bertha Dingbat, was one that Peter created for her.
Peter was looking for a character that people could relate to, a very good-hearted but a busybody that knew everybody's business, listened in unashamedly when anyone wanted to talk in a bus or at a bus stop or in a home. And this character, Bertha, she would always be herself, but she would have been somewhere the following week and she would report on that. I mean, for instance, now look, can I just quote this little bit here? I would like you to tell you about that prominent English composer, Sir Philip Carbuncle, or commonly known as Phil the Village Dill. Well, Carbuncle read Bunyan and played all the great composers. For 18 months he struggled with Chopin's Milanese, but never actually got it on. At the ripe age of 84, he got together a small musical aggravation and really went places in music. He appeared in the Orchid Room at London, the Jade Room in New York, and the Men's Room at Darlinghurst. You should hear the lovely music coming from his dining room suite, especially the movement Dinner at 8 or Bicarbonate of Soda at 9. You know, things like that. Oh, dear, they were really delightful. All good, clean fun was good. Of course, mind you, he was a very serious person in himself, but he basically wanted to create laughter because he knew people needed laughter. And he would write these scripts and we would roar with laughter, and he would enjoy them thoroughly too. But then about half an hour afterwards, you could be sitting down to a very heart-to-heart discussion about something very serious. What I mean is that he loved laughter and comedy, but it was only momentarily. He basically was a very serious person. Peter's religion was all being, I suppose. It wasn't. He just didn't believe in being a churchgoer all the time, but he just believed in practicing his own beliefs.
You can succeed if you know the power that is within you. And we published this magazine, The Pathway to Happier Living, which went to all, without any advertising, those magazines went to every part of the world. And some of them finished up at an ashram right up 8,000 feet in the Himalayas, where the Ganges River was just a mountain stream. And then I had letters from all sorts of people in India, from various groups like the Ramakrishna School in Bombay, saying, look, we love these writings of yours. Can we translate them into other languages? Can we translate them into Hindustani and Tamil and Gujarati? I said, you can do what you like with them. So those writings that came from Newcastle were then translated into these various languages. And I finished up with 20 Indian students studying Christianity.
I went back to the to his office afterwards to ask him something. It was a Friday afternoon after the program. And he said, Beryl, I've got something to show you. And he had this huge box affair, which he opened. And he said, this has just arrived from overseas. I can't remember now whether it was from India or Tibet, but it had come from one of the Asian countries. And he peeled off the wrappings and the paper and the cardboard, and eventually it was shown to be a picture of Christ. And he said, now I chose this one, this reproduction, because he said, now I'll put it up and wherever you look, you'll find that his eyes seem to follow you, and he would stand in one wall and then another wall and then the other wall of the office, and wherever he held that and you looked at that portrait or that reproduction, the eyes of Christ would seem to be looking straight at you. Well, now, I suppose if anyone was told about that, they would say he was strange, but that to me was not being strange. That was just his belief that God was good and that goodness was coming to you. If you looked at that portrait, he seemed to be looking to you and you could talk to it.
A recording Peter liked to play during the quiet hour. A choir of 10,000 voices recorded in London at the Royal Albert Hall during the Methodist Conference in 1930. Peter also liked to broadcast local choirs. One of his favourites was conducted by Mrs. Martin at Jesmond Public School.
Hello, everybody. This is 2KO calling. The time is 5 o'clock, and tonight we bring you in our school's broadcasts the students, or the pupils, rather, of Jesmond School. The choirs are conducted by Mrs. Martin.
Penfold was in the choir on the day that this song was broadcast, and she remembers Peter as a very big man with a beautiful voice.
He got on well with the kids. He tended to take care of us in his own way. As regards the school choirs, remember this is in the days before we had television, and I can remember us all trooping into 2KO, and we all had lovely white dresses on, all, freshly laundered and made and so on, and big colourful sashes. Mm. We all looked beautiful. No one could see us, of course. They could only hear us. But we did look the part. We looked lovely. And perhaps it was through being a soloist with the schools that I was chosen to be the soloist at Carols by Candlelight.
When Peter retired from radio, he moved to Lisarow on the New South Wales Central Coast, where he began working to build up the tourist industry. More than 30 years later, he was tuning around his radio dial and found 2NUR's frequency.
It was rather strange that one day I happened to be listening to radio at home, and I tuned into 2NUR FM, and I heard Cliff Thompson going on with all his nonsense. And I rather enjoyed what he was doing, and then he mentioned somebody that I'd known when he was a boy many years ago, and then Cliff went on to say, if you like the program, let me know. So I thought, okay, so I rang him up. And I told him, I said, well, I've enjoyed the fun you've gone on with, I've liked the music, because you've gone back into the past when we used to sing songs and enjoy the music. I've liked your program, Cliff. And he said, who are you? And I said, well, I don't know whether you know me, but I'm Peter Pickover. Oh, he said, my God, he said, you were compulsory listening when I was a kid. I said, well, okay. He said, would you like to come up and do some programs on NUR? I said, yes, I think it'd be fun. So he said, oh, yeah, well, okay, we'll come down and see you, and you can come up and come back and do some programs for 2NUR FM. He said, don't die in the meantime, will you? I said, I'll try not to. Anyhow, eventually I found myself on 2NUR FM doing these programs. And I thought, you know, when I came up, I was coming up for about 3 weeks, just do some little interviews with Cliff. But I experienced something that I'd never experienced before in my life. And that was a love from the people of Newcastle that had listened to me so many, many years before. And so many had got so much out of programs like the Quiet Hour, Making Friends with Music, the Afternoon Story. There were phone calls from ladies and people who were blind, who never was able to read a story but listened to my stories every day at 2 o'clock. It was really sad, the whole thing. And I began to realize that the people of Newcastle hadn't forgotten me. And I got so many requests for so many things that I just couldn't knock off.
All his life, Peter loved the sea and ships and would spend hours on ships in the port of Newcastle. But strangely enough, it wasn't until after he retired that he made his first overseas voyage. On his travels, he studied tourism, but his ultimate destination was England. Pete, of course, you were born in England, weren't you?
Yes, I think I was, yes, I was. I was born in Lancashire, yeah. But, of course, I was too young to know anything about Lancashire. I was only about two or three when I came to Australia. And I always wanted to know. I used to hear my father talking about Lancashire and all the various places, and I thought, one day I'm going to go back. I'm going to look at the place where I was born. I'm going to walk along all those roads and climb all those hills my father used to talk about. One of these days, one of these days. And eventually that day came, and I found myself at that time doing a job for the BBC, and I had to go around talking to all sorts of people, you see. So I went back to Lancashire. I caught a train from Euston one afternoon, one of these fast trains that left at 12 noon, and at 3 o'clock I was getting off the train at Preston, 300 miles up the line, in 3 hours, which was pretty good travelling. Then I had to get a train, little old buffer train, a funny little thing it was, and went out to a little village called Nelson. That was where I was born. And I knew of an old schoolmaster out there, and I stayed with him. And I decided then that I'd try an experiment. I'd try to go back as though I'd never been to Australia, that I'd always been Lancashire. And I thought, well, the first thing I've got to do is to learn to speak Lancashire, the Lancashire dialect. And I used to listen to the old schoolmaster, who was very broad, and it wasn't difficult to pick it up. And then I used to get out of the market. And in the markets, I used to stand there and listen to all these people talking. I remember one day I was going through the markets, and I'd been learning their dialect, and I was doing it pretty well. And eventually, as I was going into the market, I heard a lady speaking to a gentleman saying, "Hey, you know, if I had my chance to live over again, I wouldn't be sticking here in Lancashire. I'd be on my way. I'd go to America. I'd go and have a look at world. While I were young, I would do that, see?" And as I passed her, I said, "I am doing." And as I passed, I heard her say to the man, "What did he say?" And I heard her, so I said, "I just said, I am doing." She said, "You're doing what?" I said, "What you want to do. I'm travelling around the world." "Oh," she said, "you're not, are you?" I said, "Yes, I am." She said, "Well, where did you come from?" I said, "Well, from here. I came to here from America." And she said, "But where do you live? Where's your home?" I said, "I live in Australia." "Oh," she said, "that's funny, you talk like one of us." I said, "Well, I were born around in Neck Street about 100 years ago."
This, then, is my adventure. Now I will go with spring before me and the road calling me out into England. It doesn't matter where I go, for it's all England. I'll see what lies off the beaten track. I will, as the mood takes me, go into famous towns and unknown hamlets. I will shake up the dust of kings and abbots. I will bring the knights and the cavaliers back to the roads. And once in a while, I'll hear the thunder of old quarrels at earthwork and church door. If I become weary of dream and legend, I'll just sit and watch the ducks on the village pond. I'll talk with lords and cottagers, tramps, gypsies and dogs. I will, in fact, do anything that comes into my head as suddenly and lightheartedly as I'll accept anything and everything that comes my way in rain or sun along the road in search of England.
While in England, Peter made a very dear friend who, on the phone from her home, remembers his visit.
Peter Pickhover left England with his parents
when he was 3 years old. Life was no easier for them in Australia, especially when his mother died when he was only 8. We know now that Peter made a great success of his life in radio and later in tourism. When he decided it was time to sail to England for the first time in nearly 60 years. As soon as he had landed, he saw a postcard in a newsagent's shop window of the Orion, the ship which had taken him to Australia so long ago when he was only 3. Within a few days, I met him while staying in a hotel in Chipping Campden in Gloucestershire in England. I was very aware of the beautiful voice of the gentleman taking dinner at the next table. The following morning, we had a very amusing conversation at breakfast and spent the day together. He was travelling with Professor and Mrs. Colditz of Newcastle University, and I had an old school friend with me. We found a bluebell wood, which Peter had always longed to see. Then we drove to Broadway, one of the Cotswold villages. I slipped into a bookshop, hoping to find books on steam locomotives for my son, as we owned an industrial steam locomotive at the time. Not many people can say that. Peter was browsing and pulled out 2 books to show me the covers. He had the same books with the same bindings in his library at Gosford. A very slim book fell from between the two. It was The White Cliffs of Dover by Alice Dewar Miller. Peter had been trying to find a copy for about 35 years after hearing Lynn Fontaine read it on the radio during the Second World War in Australia. We ambled along a rough path, and I picked up a fossil and gave it to Peter, telling him it was about 250 million years old, give or take a year or two. We were driving to the hotel for dinner when both cars stopped abruptly. There was a glorious view of the Stanway Manor House. The sun was shining on the warm Cotswold stone. The grass was so lush. The lambs were cavorting around, and the petals of the abundant cherry blossom were just beginning to flutter gently to the grass. We read some of the 17th and 18th century gravestones in the little churchyard, and Peter read passages aloud from the White Cliffs of Dover. It was very special. I asked a local villager, obviously on his way to church, about the manor house. He described himself as a gentleman's gentleman, and he worked for the owners, the Earl and Countess of Weems. They were not in residence, but staying in their Scottish home at Gosford, near Edinburgh in Scotland. The following morning, Peter asked me to write down the name of the fossil, which I knew to be a lamellibranch. Fortunately, I used a sheet as my headed stationery, so Peter left on his journey with my address and telephone number. Some days later, he telephoned me at home to say he had driven up to Gosford in Scotland, introduced himself to the Countess of Weems, and was invited indoors for coffee. He told her about Gosford, Australia. She explained she had little time, as the Queen, Prince Philip, the Queen Mother, and many other members of the royal family were coming to lunch. Sometime after his return home to Australia, he wrote stories of many of the places he visited and people he had met. He recorded them all for me and included Desiderata and the 17th century nun's prayer. 2 or 3 years later, he was in England again and stayed with me, supposedly for 2 days, but that developed into about 10. I took him to Stoke Poges Church in Buckinghamshire, where the poet Thomas Gray is buried. Peter recorded Gray's elegy written in the country churchyard for me. The ploughman homeward plods his weary way and leaves the world to darkness and to me. How many times can those words be juggled around and still make a coherent sentence? I also took him to a stately home. We were revolving a globe of the world on a mahogany stand, picking out places in the world that I had visited. When we turned it further, Australia was not there. The globe had been made before Australia was discovered. I am Jeanne Barton and now live in Ashby de la Zouche in the middle of England. My life has been greatly enriched by my long friendship with Peter. It's now 1992, and I shall never receive letters from him again, but I treasure the tapes of his beautiful voice. He always concluded his letters with, "May peace and love be with you always. Sincerely, Peter."
Go placidly amid the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all people. Speak your truth quietly and clearly, and listen to others, even the dull and ignorant. They too have their story. Avoid loud and aggressive people. They are vexatious to the spirit. If you compare yourself with others, you may become vain and bitter. For always there will be greater and lesser persons than yourself. Enjoy your achievements as well as your plans. Keep interested in your own career, however humble. It is a real possession in the changing fortunes of time. Exercise caution in your business affairs, for the world is full of trickery. But let this not blind you to what virtue there is. Many people strive for high ideals, and everywhere life is full of heroism. Be yourself. Especially do not feign affection, neither be cynical about love, for in the face of all aridity and disenchantment, it is as perennial as the grass. Take kindly the counsel of the years, gracefully surrendering the things of youth. Nurture strength of spirit to shield you in misfortune. But do not distress yourself with vain imaginings. Many fears are born of fatigue and loneliness. Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars, and you have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive him to be, and whatever your labors and aspirations in the noisy confusion of life, keep peace in your soul. With all its sham drudgery and broken dreams, it's still a beautiful world. Be cheerful. Strive to be happy. And may peace and love be with you always.
A tribute to Peter Pickover was written by Graham Wilson with the voices of Ken Short, Rex Sinclair, Matt Tapp, Beryl Boardman, Pat Henwood, Judith Penfold, and Jan Barton. The producers also wish to thank Cliff Thompson, Gordon Sutherland, Eva Henderson, Colin Hankins, and organist Michael Dudman. Archival research and the restoration of historic recordings was by Ray Hugo, audio Bob Carruthers, and post-production by the AAD Media Group. A tribute to Peter Pickover was produced for 2NUR by Graham Wilson and Ray Hugo. I'm Graham Wilson.
And now it's time for me to say cheerio to you, and especially to you. Take care, and mind how you go.